Duck, duck, goose! Duck of Minerva in stereo.
This is Dan Nexon, and you're about to listen to an interview that I conducted with Nicholas Onuf at the ISA Northeast Annual Convention. Our discussion is wide-ranging, and I know I've called some of my other interviews, some of our other podcasts, wide-ranging, but this time I really mean it. This discussion is part oral history, part interview, part discussion of contemporary international relations, part rumination on where we're headed, part substantive discussion of IR theory. There's just a lot here, and it doesn't always flow the way a normal interview would. I would say it really flows more like a conversation across a table, which is, in fact, exactly how I recorded it. I hope you enjoy it. So this is Dan Nexon, and I'm talking to Nick Onuf, who I'm very pleased has agreed to take time out from the ISA Northeast Conference to do not a Skype interview, but a live in-person interview. Obviously, Nick, you know, you have an enormous presence in the field, but not all of our listeners will know who you are, because they may not be academic IR people, or they may be not that involved with constructivism or a particular kind of moment in international relations. So maybe you could start out by telling us a bit about yourself.
I'd be happy to do that, Dan. And I was just talking about myself as the luncheon speaker for the conference. So this is just more of the same. Exceedingly gracious for you to call me a presence in the field, but that's something of an exaggeration, because of the field, the nature of the field, and its fragmented, the way it has fragmented, I think, strikingly in the last decade or so. So there are places in this world, mostly outside of the U.S., where I think my work has been taken on board. In the U.S., my own country, far less so. I can't say that that this surprises me, because I always saw myself as an outsider. I should say a little more about my background so that you can see why that's I would claim any such thing as being an outsider. You guys can't see my face. I'm an old man. Well, if you saw my face, you wouldn't necessarily figure that I've been around as long as I have. But I took my first course in international relations as a 19-year-old kid, and that was 1960.
So I would not have guessed from looking at
you. You would
face.
Not have guessed. Well, the point here is, of course, that I had been basically observing close at hand, shall we call me a participant observer, in the field of international relations from its very early days. I don't date the field from before World War II the way many British scholars do. I think it's a product of peculiar circumstances in the U.S. after World War II. And so if the field has its first generation is in the late 1940s, the second generation is my generation. Because I was educated in the field and became started teaching full-time in the 1960s. I started teaching in 1966. My first journal article was published in 1969. So that's the generation in which I was shaped as a member of the field. And that field was, as Stanley Hoffman so usefully put it so long ago, an American social science. At that time, Dan, you used the word constructivism a moment ago. There was no such thing as constructivism back then. The dominant way of thinking about international relations was realism. Realism saturated the scholarship in the field of international relations. The Cold War legitimated that kind of orientation all too successfully. My personal background and inclinations at the time were liberal internationalists. And they don't fit neatly in the field as it had developed by the time I started working in it, which is the 1960s. So I faced the problem of wanting to do international relations theory, but not being comfortable being a card-carrying realist. I didn't know what to do.
So was it in fact the case that realism was quite dominant in the late 60s?
In my opinion, it was ruled the roost, mm-hmm. absolutely ruled the roost. In the 70s, there's a little difference I'll talk about. But in the 1960s, I think there's no question. So I couldn't shake my interest in liberal institutionalist affairs liberal institutionalist perspective on international affairs. So I took a field of study in international law and organization. And my first teaching position was in international law and organization. And at the time, you basically couldn't teach those subjects in a political science curriculum. Some undergraduate curricula still had international law to prepare students for law school, and some graduate curricula had an international institutions course for MA students who were interested possibly in working for an organization like the United Nations. But by and large, in a political science department, you didn't have a choice. You had to teach international relations, and you had to be a realist for all intents and purposes. This is in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Now, my first job was teaching in a professional school of international affairs, Georgetown School of Foreign Service.
Well,
I'm sure you knew that, Dan, actually.
I actually did not.
You did not?
Yeah.
Well, I was on the faculty in the Department of Government with all my course, almost all of my teaching responsibilities in the School of Foreign Service from 1966 to 1970. Mm-hmm. I wasn't happy there. At the time, Georgetown was a very conservative institution, much less so today. At the time, the Vietnam War made this something that was personally consequential. You couldn't not have your politics a part of your daily life in those circumstances. And I wasn't happy there. So in 1970, I had the opportunity to move up the road, 2.5 miles or something like this, to America, to American University, and where I stayed for another 24 years. So I spent 28 years teaching in professional schools of international affairs because they still offered courses in international law and institutions, because that was, everyone could see that from a professional point of view, people needed those kinds of courses. From professional means diplomacy, journalism, employment in international organizations, multinational corporations, and so on. The world of, in higher education, international relations as a field of study is somehow sharply segregated from these professional programs of international affairs. And for many reasons, I think this is deleterious. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to do theory, which is what I wanted to do, it had to be in a political science department or as an afterthought in a professional school of international affairs. If you wanted to do international law and organization, it had to be in a professional school of international affairs. Otherwise, it was impossible in the U.S. in any event.
And this was because of sort of prevailing realist presuppositions,
yes,
that this stuff didn't matter, we didn't need to know about it, it was inconsequential?
Exactly, Dan. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Things have changed a lot. And it's surprising to me that because it's my personal history that other people don't realize what it was like back then. So I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to commit myself in this setting and tell you how I felt about it. It's personal for me. Mm-hmm. As a scholar, I felt some considerable alienation from the field I was trained in. And part of it had to do with my own ill ability to reconcile realism and liberal internationalism in any intelligible way. And we were taught not that they were not reconcilable. That was the whole point of the early, important early books like E.H. Carr's The 20 Years Crisis and Hans Morgenthau's Scientific Man versus Power Politics.
I think from the vantage point of the early 21st century, that's not how many of us now appropriate those texts, right? So we go back and we read E.H. Carr, you know, as much for his, you know, Power Politics Without Purpose is Nothing. Right?
Yeah, and I was talking about this just an hour ago.
Yeah.
I think that's just a bad reading of Carr. I think it does not reflect his intentions. But then, who knows what his intentions were? It's always dangerous to talk about authors' intentions. Anyone's intentions, anyway. Certainly, in the climate of the Cold War era, the intelligible reading, the common intelligible reading of Carr was that you were a realist or you were an idiot. And that's what the term utopian told you. I still read, just reread recently, the first chapter in the book, and I still see it the way I saw it, 40-some years ago. So now, that's my story, part one. Part two is where the term constructivism starts to come to play. This is the great upheaval in the humanities and in some measure in the social sciences, starting in the late 1970s, I guess, really increased in momentum throughout the 1980s, even filtered into our little field of study at the end of the decade. This upheaval was partly a rejection of big science, and which of course had provided an enormous amount of funding for universities in the United States, and that's why it's important to point out that the point of departure here was the humanities, because the sciences and the social sciences that could pretend to be scientific were garnering huge proportion of all the resources available in universities, but more than that, they were taking students away from humanities departments, which are on the verge of folding up. Classics departments, for example, were seriously threatened by the draining away of students. Well, the humanists mounted a counterattack by claiming that the science, if you look at it carefully as a philosopher, you will see is nothing other than the social construction. It's contingent. There's nothing natural or necessary about what we call science. That's a very powerful claim. Doesn't affect scientists very much, but it did have electrify the humanities and spilled over into the social sciences for those of us who were always skeptical about the claims that we could do science. I would claim that all of us, specifically excluding myself, but I'm talking about the community of people who made international relations what it was at the time, though they all thought that that science brought you resources, credibility, and the attention of governments. It's a way to go. I was never persuaded of this. I thought most of the money was wasted. I thought most of the research that was conducted in the name of science was frivolous. I won't take a virus to say it was mindless, but it was pretty damn close. So people like me were susceptible to this uprising in the humanities, and we started reading exotic continental social theory and with transformative consequences. Now, at the same time, everybody knows this, at the same time the feminist revolution really hit home. This started again in humanities departments and universities. So much of it did in the context of universities. I don't mean the feminist movement started in the universities, but its impact in universities
begins in the humanities
and then percolates through gradually, barely making it to engineering, if indeed making it at all to engineering even today. But the feminists, and I was directly and personally affected by this. My doctoral students were feminists. I mean, they just jumped all over me for my unreflective sexist ways. They were right. They were right, and they taught me a very important lesson about they call it the patriarchy, but it's bigger than that. It's just it's the power of privilege, and in the university world, people like me are extraordinarily privileged. The two of us, Dan, this is the good life. We're protected from practically everything in the world that can hurt, except ourselves. So we manage to hurt each other and ourselves, but outsiders. I don't know if I should say this publicly.
Well, I mean, I always tell people that, I get paid to do and think about things that I want to do and think about, and that's a very exceptional and unusual circumstance in human history. There aren't that many professions that have that form, or where, you know, and I've spent a little bit of time working in government bureaucracies. I spent some time working in media consulting, and you know, it's just a very different, you know, it was stimulating, but it's not, you are in an environment that feels to you much more hierarchical, right? At least as it impinges upon you.
Yes. No, exactly. Exactly.
But at the same time, there are world's smallest violins. I mean, Dan Dresner described, being an academic as every day is a working Saturday, in the sense that there's always more you can do. It's not like right. You come home from work and say, I'm done.
No, and we're never done. Not ever.
And then there's the insecurity and the elevation of office politics to the state disciplinary stakes that are way outside.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I think, so what's interesting for me just hearing this, and you haven't even really fully gone into it, was, so I started college in the early 1990s, right?
You were just a kid.
Right, yeah. Well, I'm gray now and stuff. But sort of in grad school in 95, mm-hmm. right? So it was really right. kind of at the you know, and I started from a position, I took women's studies courses, right? And I started from a position which was very much, you know, okay, this stuff's kind of, you know, I would never, you know, where I would never self-describe as being, you know, a deep feminist any sort of way, but, you know, I knew the basic theory, right? You know,
sure.
And I took that sort of stuff seriously. And so for me, the sort of, when I came into academic international relations, this is sort of quaint, right? Why are we arguing about Alex Wendt? This is like the tip of the iceberg, right? You know, this is the obvious stuff, right? There's the less yeah. obvious stuff, you know, that I was taking my Lacanian feminism class or what have you.
Right.
But that's sort of, it's not the biography that I actually wanted to talk about on my, you know, it's that to us, we look back and, you know, I think a lot of us, no matter where we are in these debates, right, we go back and we look at, you know, Bob Cohen's, right, you know, reflexivism and whatever, reflectivism and rationalism. We look at, you know, the, you know, Ann Tickner's, you know, engagement in this sort of stuff. And I don't think we have that sense of what the intellectual environment was like.
No, yeah,
I think
right.
it looks kind of quaint. Like, why are we arguing over these things, you know, and why do people feel threatened?
Which of course, is more generally how young women seem to feel about feminism overall, is I think it's quaint, which pisses off the feminists of my generation no end. Mm.
But what I'm hearing for you is that this really was a fight in which some people, you know, in which all the sides who were engaged in it felt like, you know, the future of their discipline, the future of knowledge, their personal futures were to some degree on the line. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The stakes were great.
Mm.
what's important to emphasize here is that the people who were affected in our field were relatively few in number. I mean, not just relative, but they were really few in number. Mm-hmm. We're talking a dozen and a half, couple of dozen people who really were engaged in a way that you could see that they shifted ground in the most fundamental way in their scholarly interests and practices. It's important to emphasize how small the group was because the ripple effects have been huge. Not so much in this country, but in the rest of the world, where the upheaval of the 1980s has really, I think, still resonates in extraordinarily powerful ways. I feel much more comfortable. I teach regularly now for 6 weeks a year in Rio, in Brazil. I feel at home there in a way that I don't even in my own country. When I go to Europe, I go fairly often. Mm-hmm. I'm at home there too.
But to sort of be blunt about it, there's a dark side to that, which is that I guess I'm going to be on the record saying this. I spend a fair amount of time in Britain, and the stories about institutional sexism in the British Academy, you know, seem way be you know much worse than in the United States.
Well, I think they are, and I think mm-hmm. that as much as I find the intellectual environment in my department at the PUCI, it's called the Pontifical University in Rio, a congenial one, it is congenial. Mm-hmm. There's still that. I mean, the Brazilian. Of course they're sexist. I shouldn't say it goes without saying, but I went and said it because it seems to me it's important to show how easy it is for us to be hypocritical about these things. Mm-hmm. It is, in my opinion, not the case that the posties, as we call them so often, the people who were post-positivists, post-structuralists, post-modern, post-modernists, whatever term you want to use, however we describe ourselves, it's not the case that they uniformly felt themselves in some league with the feminists. Mm-hmm. Some of us did, some of us did not. Mm-hmm. And indeed, some people who were not posties felt very strongly identified with the feminist movement. For example, Joshua Goldstein, mm-hmm. As reflected in his textbook and in his published work, his scholarly work.
But the takeaway message I'm getting from you is that looking back now, we should not underestimate the degree to which the importation of various kinds of isms from humanities, particularly feminism, but also post-structuralism, other types of approaches, the way those rocked the field.
They rocked the field.
And then also, in particular, the way in which, even if the alignment was contingent, there are ways, in particular with feminism, where there really was not just an intellectual debate, there was a debate in which there were stakes over resources in the field and attitudes in the field and the lived environment of the people.
That's nicely put. Yeah. But now I have some second thoughts about the term rocked. Hmm? I have some second thoughts about the term rocked. I'm not sure that the field was rocked. I think what happened was that the core of the field, the large number of people who identify themselves as scholars in the field of international relations thought this was a fringe movement, and the people on the fringe didn't help because they used terms like "we're in exile." They were not exiled; they exiled themselves. They called themselves dissidents, as if to say, "We're going to be a pain in the ass for you people, but we're not going to try to engage in a constructive way." I think there was a real failure of moral responsibility here that should not be ignored, and which I've never heard any of us say until this moment, to tell you the truth. But there was a failure of moral responsibility. And so the field went its merry way, and the fringe went its own small, discordant way. None of us were able actually to build on each other's work very much at all. so that you have constructivists of many stripes, you have posties of many stripes, all of whom are perfectly happy to tear each other up and down and all around, and view the so-called mainstream as the enemy. I hate to put it in such strong terms, but that's conventionally what we say now. But it's a comfortable enemy because it's pushed away from us.
It's funny because Patrick and I have been talking about, we talked about this in one of our very early podcasts. We've also written about this in a piece that's under review for a special issue, and who knows whether it'll appear or not. But, you know, the way to which there's a sort of core periphery structure of debate in the field, intellectual structure in IR theory.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, as you say, you know, if you continue to spend, if you spend all your time primarily focusing on, you know, not building on each other's work and then focusing on, you know, sort of, I'd say that, and then focusing on sort of gunning at, you know, Walt, Cohen, you know, and I use these as last names deliberately because you're not gunning at Ken, you're not gunning at, you know, Bob, you're gunning at, you know, the name, that does wonders for the citation count of the mainstream, right? So you, in a sense,
exactly.
are reproducing the idea that there are a number of, a set group of figures and a set group of arguments that are at the center, because you're spending all your time saying at the center and attacking them rather than doing something to build a concern. Anyway, but go on.
Well, good. Well, so the crescendo for this, at this part of this chapter in the story is that in 1989 I published a book called World of Our Making, the great book that has been widely cited but never read. That's not the only book about which that can be said.
We could do an entire like 6-part series of podcasts on drive-by citations.
Yes, you definitely could.
Well, I've read it.
Well, I thank you very much, Dan. And I just read your book in Rio two or three months ago. I really loved it, have to tell you.
So you published this book that, now my understanding is that the folk stories in the field are that, you know, this is where you invented the term constructivism to describe Skoll and Bovaer. Okay, so that is correct.
That is correct.
And this is the book that really did it,
This is the book that said we can systematically think about international relations by using a language in social theory that's about constitution, construction, contingency, and so on, a language which is just not normally available to scholars in the field. But the most important thing about the book, I think, well, I'll tell you frankly, the most important thing about the book is the name of the book. It was a moment of inspiration to call it World of Our Making, because that resonates for people. They get something out of that. They see that that's something different, saying something different. Oh, we did it. We did it to ourselves. We made this. We continue to make it. Mm-hmm. And who's this we? And so on. It pushes you in the direction. You don't have to have read the book to have been pushed in the right direction. Mm-hmm. What the book, I think, does that was most important, looking back, is tell people that this pushing is a matter of language. It's always a matter of language. Social construction is a matter of language. The condition of rule are, in the end, matters of language. You have to take what philosophers call the language turn, or you can't get out of a certain way of thinking about international relations the way we thought about it for 2 generations or more.
So you're saying that intellectually, I mean, I don't want to tear us away from the argument of the book itself, but I do think it's really significant to highlight that, you know, it is a linguistic turn vision, right, and a rule-based, right, in terms of language games and language rules, understanding constructivism, because I think for many people who are trying to find their way through constructivism in the early 90s, you know, there was sort of a sense that there was the ONIF version, which was language and rules, and then there was the sort of what became known as the Wendtian version, which was sort of norms and identity, right? Although I don't think it's fair to saddle Alex with all, you know, that.
No, in fact, it's not norm. Even norms is not really his largest concern. I think you have to say that that's people like Marty Fenimore.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in a sense that if we wanted to pull this apart, we would talk about a norms-based constructivism, an identity-based constructivism,
exactly,
a role in linguistic-based constructivism. And I actually, when I was interviewing Catherine, I asked her about, why she thought norms constructivism had sort of eclipsed identity-based constructivism, and she had an answer for that. But so it sounds like, though, the world of our making really came out of this stew of the 80s where you were doing international law. I don't think it's accidental that the most important kind of constructivists and proto-constructivists were often international law people like Fritz Kotkaniemi and yourself, right?
Yeah.
I think there's a reason for that.
There is a reason for that, absolutely.
And maybe we can explore that in a second. But so you're teaching, and you've been in a position where you've been trying to articulate against a mainstream, articulate an argument that international law matters, right? Against a sort of dominant intellectual project in the field that says it doesn't matter at all, right? So, then you are in this intellectual environment where your students are challenging you on a feminist perspective. You're reading now from the humanities. You're reading various continental critical theorists of various stripes, continental theorists, post-structuralists, linguistic turn theorists. And this is what produces World of Our Making.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what produces it.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say parenthetically here, very self-interestedly, World of Our Making has been out of print for many, many years. One reason why people haven't read it was out of print, but it has just been reissued by Routledge in the last few weeks. You can get it again. We'll see if anyone does, but anyway.
We'll make sure we associate it with the write-up.
They were great.
Right. All 40 people who listen to me. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
The thing about international law that's really interesting to me, its importance, you did say it point blank, its importance to constructivism cannot be belied, in my opinion, cannot be. But the problem for international law is that it is always associated with a liberal stance. And my own struggles with liberal internationalism, which accelerated in the 1970s when I toyed with Marxism, Wallerstein, for example, and I started thinking seriously about what Marxists mean by domination and exploitation. And how does that comport with a preoccupation with law, which is, of course, a liberal preoccupation? At least we tend to see it as a liberal preoccupation.
Well, you're at critical legal studies, right?
Yeah, no. And it's interesting you should mention that, Dan, because I was writing a great deal of international legal theory at the time, and the first book I wrote, edited actually, but had a very long essay in, was subject to a devastating critique by someone in the CLS, the Critical Legal Studies movement, precisely because I hadn't yet liberated myself from the shackles of liberal internationalism and had only begun to scratch the surface of social theory. This was still in the late 1970s. It took another decade for me to work all this out. But so distinctive elements of World of Our Making is the emphasis on the relationship between rules and rule, the condition of rule and its bestowal of privilege, a few at the expense of many. That's not a liberal take on the world. And it's not something most international lawyers, CLS people exempted, find congenial. Should any of the listeners here like to get the really brilliant exposition of what's at stake here. From a CLS perspective, they should read Martti Kostaniemi's book called Apology and Utopia. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Dan. It's the most important book in international law of the last 30 years, in my opinion. Maybe the same year as my book, just about anyway, 1989. So, his name is spelled Kostaniemi. It's a Finnish name.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant scholar. So there's quite a brew here in the constituents that are very carefully linked together in World of Our Making. And they are linked as systematically, I think, as one can. I certainly could make them. Among other things, then, the book is a final repudiation of my own liberal institutionalist past, and the final divorce between me and the kind of people I grew up with who had to... grew up with, I mean now, as a scholar, grew up with, and having to deal with the hegemony of realism. I'm talking about people like Bob Cohen and Orrin Young. I mean, people my age, almost exactly. I think Bob is 2 weeks older than I am, or 2 weeks younger, something like that.
At one point, you sort of saw yourselves as all allied against realism.
No, I don't think we ever did.
Okay.
So what happened was that most of them, it's very interesting what happened. They staged a coup. And the coup was to take over the journal International Organization, which had been founded by the members of the by scholarly participants in the San Francisco Conference. So they were called the San Francisco Generation.
I've actually gone back and read very old issues of I.O.
You've seen it.
Right.
You've seen it.
Yeah.
It could have been out of the 1930s.
Yeah.
And so in about 1967, 68... somewhere about then, these young guys, Joe Nye, Bob Cohen, David Kay, Ray Hopkins, Orrin Young, Steve Krasner, who was their house realist, the cover, gave them cover.
Right.
They took over the journal, and they used it very successfully, very subtly, to soften realism's edges. And they did this chiefly through special issues, such as on transnational actors or on the global economy or...
the regimes thing.
And especially regimes, right. And when so Krasner writes the lead essay in which he says, oh, regimes are an intervening variable. He gives a small little perch in the realist order of things for the liberal institutionalists. And they're not happy with this. I mean, it's not enough, but it's enough for them to stay in the fight, so to speak. I was out of the fight because I was publishing in the American Journal of International Law. Because
this is what I was actually going to ask you, which is where were you publishing during this time? Were you publishing in international law?
I was publishing
yes.
I was doing international legal theory because there was no way for me to do international theory in the circumstance.
So this is really, you know, this is a whole, I mean, I had no idea, right? And I, you know, now I'm sort of flitting forward and thinking about, you know, a lot of younger scholars I talk to now, and I don't, not me as a younger scholar, I'm, you know, nearly
younger
40,
than you.
Right? Much younger, right? You know, people
right.
are...
the next generation.
Just, you know, the generation after me, right? The generation that's grown up in an era in which, you know, mixed methods are king and all that sort of stuff, right? To them, I think this is all, they are almost entirely, right, unless they come out of a very narrow range of programs, they're almost entirely anti-realist and not in the scientific realist sense, in the sense of political realism, right? They view realists as, you know, I think that they primarily view realism as this old thing that's kind of hanging around and, you know, and good work doesn't talk about it and they get annoyed when they're made to engage with it. I mean, so in that sense, right, the idea, this it's very hard for even for me, right, to imagine a world in which realism is really intellectually hegemonic. I mean, for me, even growing up, you know, I think Patrick and I have talked about this for some time. It was like, well, realism was what people bashed. But if you really look closely, how many people were really citing realist work in a positive way? Right. It was all this, you know, with, you know, Ken Waltz. And I've written a piece that's actually, I think, a very sympathetic reconstruction of Waltz's work with Stacey Goddard. But, you know, but it also understands what the politics were when we were doing this sort of stuff. And they're like, oh, let's reclaim realism. Why, for a lot of people, this was just very, we don't want to go there. So it really was dominant.
It really was dominant. You know, John Vasquez wrote a book called The Power of Power Politics. It stemmed from a convention paper he gave called mm-hmm. Color at Morgenthau.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right. Everybody in my generation, just to start with, read Morgenthau's textbook. It's the first book I read. I was hooked
mm-hmm.
on the field as a 19-year-old kid when I read this book. And in the cultural...
And now we don't even remember that it's a textbook, right? I mean, but anyway, go on.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And in the cultural and political context of the 1950s, 60s, up to the end of the Vietnam War, it made perfect sense. It made perfect sense. And years ago, I had a colleague who did a little survey research on attitudes about international relations in departments and agencies of the United States government.
Well, their realist discourse is still completely dominant. I mean...
Exactly. Yeah. It was set in place from the 1940s and has been dominant ever since.
Let me actually qualify that. I would say that a kind of baseline realist discourse is dominant, particularly language of the national interest, right, when you make arguments. But I would say that that's heavily qualified, right? For one thing, one of the reasons why it's very hard for some of us to look back and say, well, why weren't people taking international law seriously, is the way that international law is institutionalized in the American DOD, Department of State, you know, these bureaucracies. They're really, you know, everything has to be reviewed. It's true that, you know, a John Yoo can change your interpretation of that, but by and large, you know, there's a sense that international law is deeply embedded in practice and has a constraining and enabling effect, right? Number one. And number two, that so values, norms, building international order, there's a sort of liberal internationalism there too. I don't want to go all the way, but I would say that the base language is definitely one of kind of power politics.
Yeah, I agree with you the way you put that pretty thoroughly. I would amend it slightly to say that the effect of law during that time was largely confined to offices of legal advisors or legal counsels in the departments and agencies of the U.S. federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And in practice, anything that's written for public consumption or for purposes of treaty making, international agreement, negotiation, and so on, is vetted with the legal counsel's office. Political scientists never took on board that that's what was happening. So when they interviewed public policy personnel, and they did a lot, my old friend was just one of many, they didn't talk to the Office of Legal Counsel, and they never asked, well, what happens to this document when you're finished with it? Never asked that question. A number of us used to try to point that out to people to very little effect. Teaching for many years in Washington, I saw that happening because I had lawyers for neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you live in you're a Washington guy now.
Well, I spent a year in DOD on one of these international affairs fellowships, and I had, you know, we had talking points that were rewritten to accord with, you know, Office of Legal Counsel, and you know, every major policy that might impinge on some legal issue had to go through and be vetted, and the assumption was that if we were in contravention of their understanding of our legal obligations, they would nix it, right? It would have to be rewritten, or so. Anyway, I mean, I don't want to get too much on the tangent, but it is, you know, there is this deep irony with kind of the hard nosed character of the way that a certain generation of realists would articulate their position, but without apparently really, you know, following the policy process, right? But this is also where you get into the idea that international law becomes a natural subject to articulate constructivism from, not only because you have, you know, various kinds of institutional mechanisms in place that require states to at least pay lip service to following legal norms, right? But also because you have the tradition of customary law and the idea that you can build up social expectations that have some sort of constitutive force, if not regulative force, in the world. So what you're saying is that a group of people, started to sort of fight back. They took over International Organization.
With extraordinary success. Yeah. When we look at the journal. It remains the dominant journal.
Well, it's funny because when I was in grad school, right, the journal that everybody talked about, so the recipe for success when I was in grad school was you got a piece into world politics, right? And then you had your dissertation along, you got a job, you know, you published your dissertation. If you can get into world politics, then it was maybe IO, then it was maybe RIS or ISQ, right? Now it's IO.
It's IO.
If you're international relations, you compare it to politics, not so much.
No,
but,
not so much.
Right.
But it's right, exactly.
But they're extraordinarily successful, such that IO is in some respects, you know, the politics of IO are way beyond me, right? They
Well, one of the interesting things about this process is that the principal here is Bob Cohane.
Mm-hmm.
And Cohane, you remember Nye and Cohane's book? Well, actually, it's Cohane and Nye's book, Power and Interdependence.
Oh, actually, I took my first international relations course from Joe Nye at Harvard, we read Power and Interdependence, and we had lots of questions about Power and Interdependence. I still remember him, you know, giving a lecture on how it, you know. We shouldn't be so concerned about, this is, of course, the Japan is number one era, because, you know, they're building plants here and it's all interdependence, right? Yeah. You know, and it was a great course.
But, well, that book is dated 1977. Yeah. And they were working on elements of it, of it for most of the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is an attempt to sneak in liberal institutionalism by making it seem harmless to realists. That's my interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1980s, Bob decided that was not enough. I think it's mostly Bob. By this time, Joe's hanging out in Washington a lot. He's in the Carter government, that's in the end of the 70s, right? And lose track of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Cohane sees an opportunity. We know he's an opportunistic guy. I don't mean that in any invidious way. He seizes his opportunities.
Well, that's a very desirable character trait.
One would think. It may be that often that sometimes we neglect to do just that, to take advantage of our opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So he saw the move in economics and political science towards rational choice theory as an opportunity.
So you get the transaction cost argument, and then you ultimately get the internal critique of structural realism that we know of as neoliberal institutionalism.
You get it all.
Mm-hmm.
So and you get it in a way that actually one-ups the realist rather than making yourself a little perch in the realist camp, you've now stepped aside, stepped over them by doing something the realists should have done for themselves, which is, and a few did, which is to say, oh, rational choice is the way we can do it. The clearest example of that was this peculiar blend of structural functionalism and microeconomic theory that Waltz undertook, that you and Stacy wrote about, in the theory of international politics. Well, that sort of appropriation of realism and of the credibility of microeconomics as a rationalist undertaking, Bob really masterfully co-opted that and made it impossible for realists not to take liberal institutionalism seriously because it was rational. And then Bob went, and I think with extraordinary skill and success, undertook to encourage young scholars to talk about the rational design of international institutions and so on.
Mm-hmm.
This is, from the point of view of scholarship, the high tide. It's about the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
This is the high tide for liberal institutionalism.
Well, I mean,
there's one version of it.
Well, I think what's you know, obviously there's now been some interesting discussion. You've seen the special issue on American, you know, IPE and American is, you know, IP, the TRIPS inspired, you know, American IPE versus, I can't remember the name of the special issue now, in which, you know, Bob distanced himself a little and said Helen was, you know, Milner was sort of more responsible for some of the stuff that people are unhappy about. But irrespective of that sort of stuff, I mean,
God, we're such gossips, aren't we? But, irrespective of that sort of stuff, I mean, liberal institutionalism is no longer liberal institutionalism, right? It's what we now have is open economy politics, I think it's in the same family, right? Which is to say that that you know, sort of rational domestic interests, you know, models, market choice analytic models. But I would say that it's become so that elements of that, and I don't know enough about the ins and outs of OEP and the debate that's going on about it to really comment on it in a smart way. But I would say is that that you've had that. You've also had the sort of really path-breaking stuff that Jim Furon did, right, on audience costs and all that sort of stuff. And we reached a point, and this is something that people who've heard me talk before, read what I was sort of a broken record about, but we now have a sort of set of sort of off-the-shelf rationalist mechanisms that you can deploy in an article and everybody says, oh, okay, right, okay, it's a veto, we understand it's a credible commitment issue, or we understand it's a veto point, or we understand it's, you know, it's a kind of, a lock-in effective trade or what have you. Right. So in that sense, I don't think there are no practicing liberal institutionalists anymore, but there are a lot of people doing things that are in the of liberal institutionalism.
Here I disagree.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I disagree, number one, because following on the institutional design move, Bob got people interested in what he called legalization.
So, okay.
Okay, so this is now to bring international law back into the fold so that it becomes international law at institutions. Now, we can go back to the 1930s without embarrassment. We have tools. You just identified some of these tools in which to show that this is how the world works. Furthermore, there was another stream of liberal internationalism, which, of course, was undercover for a decade because it called itself, would you guess, constructivism.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, this is an argument that I'm glad to hear this, because Patrick and I have been making this argument for a while, and this is in some of the early playing with realist constructivism, which Sammy eventually wrote, right, you know, his book, which was to say that there was we always sort of tell this stylized story about a bifurcation of liberalism in the 80s, where you have a sort of liberal rationalist group, and then you have sort of what we might call sociological liberalism, and that sort of goes underground and disappears, and it resurfaces as constructivism, or at least as mainstream American constructivism.
Right. They appropriate the name, the word constructivism, and but I can't see how it's anything other than a jazzed up liberal institutionalism.
Well, it's liberalism in the political philosophic sense,
right,
rather than in, you know, it may not have the same ingredients precisely of what
it doesn't have
the,
it's more interested in informal phenomena rather than formal. So they use the term norms instead of rules, as if rules were necessarily legal rules. Those are small differences in my opinion, Dan.
So I want to circle us all the way back, right?
Not all the way back, but
I want to circle us back a bit. So you say that the publication of World of Our Making, right, is a inflection point, right?
It's an inflection point, not just my book, Fritz's book too.
Yeah.
Right. It's an inflection point. And there's nothing really, from the posties, there's nothing really of comparable consequence because they're so flaky. They're my friends.
This is going to win us lots of friends and allies, right?
They're my friends. They'll forgive me for saying this. The closest book point to this inflection point, which was roughly 1989, would be Rob Walker's Inside Outside.
There's also David Campbell's Writing Security, which sort of gets into the securitization, sort of becomes a kind of securitization.
Right, I should mention that.
But it is true that it seemed like in the late 80s, there's a critical mass of people, James Derderian, who are doing this, really kind of doing a more radical post-structuralist vision in a lot of different ways, but they kind of go different places.
This is part of the problem. They go different places, and where they go doesn't look or smell or feel like international relations anymore. Mm-hmm. This becomes part of the problem. Mm-hmm. What Fritz and I tried to do, the subtitles of our books tell you what we tried to do. His subtitle says something about domestic affairs and international relations. My subtitle says something about international relations and social theory, mm-hmm. we try to, I hate to use a overworked metaphor like build a bridge, but we try to make international relations an intelligible part of a theoretic enterprise that was bigger than international relations, without losing what we call, some sense of what we call international relations as our substantive concern. Whereas so many of the post-positivists, post-structuralists, just simply flew off.
Well, I think what happens is that a lot of people, I wasn't there, but retrospectively, it looks like a lot of people become really about international studies, right? And so you have arguments about strong intertextualism, where we can kind of study any kind of artifact, and this is all within the...
Yeah, I don't know about calling it international studies, though, Dan.
Well, regardless, so there's an inflection point with your work and Fritz's book and, you know, a bunch of other sort of stuff. And you say then there's another chapter, right?
We have then there's another chapter. Right. And this chapter is the explosion of international relations globally. Mm-hmm. I don't remember now if I remarked on this earlier, but I should have. When, after World War II, international relations.
You said it was, Stanley Hoffman was right, it's an American social science, it's, the Germans come over and they meet up with some Americans and they...
the most important feature of that probably is the dramatic expansion in higher education in the U.S. at the time, thanks to the GI Bill, opens up opportunities to create institutional cover for people doing something different. Mm-hmm. So we have fields like international relations and, another example, social psychology are invented at this time in a context which is in which there's a tremendously it's really a favorable environment for institution building. And then we're seeing the same phenomenon again, not in the U.S., where, if anything, we're contracting, mm-hmm. but we see it all over the rest of the world. It's extraordinary. I mean, the doubling rate for the number of courses in the field of international relations must be something like every 5 years. I wouldn't be surprised if it's something like that, Dan. Mm-hmm. It's just mind-boggling how fast it's going.
Well, I know that one of the we certainly noticed that trend in our PhD applications and admits, and the growing number of highly credible applicants coming from East Asia or coming from Central Europe or coming from wherever.
I'm teaching in Brazil. These kids are terrific. Yeah. They're just terrific. Mm-hmm. So what's happening is that you have business as usual in the U.S. The international relations is a field of political science, and the large trends in political science inevitably percolate into international relations. Faculties of political science are always fighting, duking it out over resources. Do we hire another Americanist? Do we hire a comparativist? Should we get rid of political theory altogether because students aren't interested in it, although it turns out in some institutions, students are exceedingly interested in political theory, but right. It's business as usual in the U.S., whereas abroad, there's extraordinary expansion with the development of departments of international relations and strong claims that we need a discipline. Mm-hmm. Well, in the U.S., it's never going to be a discipline. It's always going to be a field in another in a bigger discipline. Abroad, all of this claims on behalf of discipline, which is, seems to me, largely driven by the availability of resources suddenly, unexpectedly, is forcing people to... You go to a dean and you say, can we have a Department of International Relations? The dean says, sure, of course you can. But what is international relations? And you say, well, we're a discipline. And, if you're a discipline, of course you can have a department. End of story. Well, but what is this discipline? This is a question that Europeans, that Asians, the South Americans, and so on, I don't think they're in a position to answer. Well, they have vague language like, it's about the international. You read international political sociology.
Mm-hmm. was on the first group of editorial editor assistants book, who yeah. helped, you know, select right. reviewers. So.
Yeah. Well, you know how many pieces invoke the international. What are they talking about? Do they know what they're talking about? Mm-hmm. Do they have the slightest idea how this might differ from something we've always called loosely international relations? It's even vaguer. And I'm all for social theory. I've been saying this repeatedly during this this discussion of ours, Dan. But this increasing this preoccupation with ever more peripheral social theorists, people who are farther and farther removed from the social reality that we identify with the global experience. I mean, look at. Right now, hot figure is Bruno Latour, right? All kinds of Europeans are trying to adapt.
Now I'm supposed to be in a forum on actor network theory.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So Latour is a very interesting mind, and the actor network theory derives from his experience looking at how lab science actually functions. Well, to what extent is this could be extrapolated to anything we're interested
in? But this is like a lot of where I think the quote-unquote practice turn is going, right? Which is sort of an anthropology of international relations, right? So, you know, studying... You know, so I was just at a conference in New York that, you know, I can't remember all the... You know, Jacob Sending, Ivor Neumann, Vincent Pilliot, you know, and it was, you know, this new study of diplomacy movement, right? Which is let's go out and study diplomats and figure out what they do. And let's think about the practice of diplomacy as constitutive. And there you have, you know, people, you know, Vincent is following people around at the UN to figure out how they establish status hierarchies, right? You've got, you know, Ivor's work from his experience in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And so I think some of the ANT work, right, is trying to use those tools to understand how defense agencies and national security agencies and ministries of foreign affairs work. And to me, I can see that, right? What I'm more concerned with is that there's, and maybe this is where we would converge, and this is also something that Patrick and I have said or are trying to say in print, is that... You know, if you're going, is we think we need to have plenty of robust social theory debate in international relations, but we have to know what the stakes are, right? And the stakes can't be sort of reflexive. They can't be that the stake of the phenomenological turn is we got to take phenomenology seriously, right? That's not a stake, right? It's got to be a kind of, you know, what is sort of puzzling or difficult about the way that we conceptualize the world, that if we change our lens slightly, that will start falling into place, right? And I think that if I think back to the social theoretic work of the 80s and 90s, it was very, a lot of it, at least what we remember, your work and others, was very grounded in this notion that there are things that we need to explain. And we're not necessarily providing you with middle range theories, but providing you with a apparatus, not a scientific ontology to tackle these things. And we're going to tell you why ours gives you insights that other ones don't. And I feel like some of that's being lost in the social theory debate that we have now.
I agree. Yeah. I think you were much more eloquent about this than I was.
No,
you've been thinking about it probably more than I have.
A lot lately. Discipline's been getting on my mind lately. But I didn't have this perspective is really interesting because I haven't really been engaged in kind of teaching outside of the United States. And my networks are primarily European. I mean, I think I've been to East Asia once, right? Mm-hmm. The sense in which a lot of what we're seeing now, really at the ISA, and we are at the ISA Northeast right now, which is 20% overseas or something this year.
Is it that high?
Yeah, it's really high.
That's wonderful.
Is the globalization of IR, right? And
it's what's happening now that seems to me will be transformative for this generation.
Well, as somebody who is teaching now in a Brazilian institution, how do you see your place or your role in this globalization of IR?
Well, you're asking me, in effect, to give you the bottom line of
the
lunch
final
and
chapter,
talk today,
right? Or of what you've said is the current chapter, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it seems to me, as a general matter, that if you take a generational perspective, and this is what we've been doing here, Dan, if you take a generational perspective, you have the young generation, the apprentices, they're in their 20s, You have the masters, they're in their 40s, and almost all of the major figures that we've been talking about made their major contributions when they were in somewhere from the late 30s to their early 50s. Mm-hmm. I looked up all the dates. It's just amazing how consistently that's the case. There is a time frame in which your mastery is such that you really can say something important. You can. It doesn't mean you will, but you can. Mm-hmm. And then another generation passes, and you become, I mean, people invite you to give luncheon speeches, and it's very nice. Mm-hmm. But what you're just a grand old man. You provide legitimacy, mm-hmm. respectability for the generation below you, your generation now. You guys can go and do the hard work, make a difference, and I'll write a blurb for your next book and saying, this guy has got it, he's doing it, it's great, read this now, right? Well, you know.
I would have to argue with you about some of the kind of particular kind of pessimistic tone, but I do see the blurb thing, right?
Well, you know, I got a blurb on Patrick's book.
Right, of course. Right.
I love the book. It's a great book. I think it's arguably going to turn out to be the most important book of this generation. He's a little young. He was only 39 when he wrote the book.
Yeah, it's Patrick, you know.
Yeah, I know, it's Patrick. And in some respects, I think it ends in a whimper. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, this business about pluralist science and so on. I told him.
Well, I think that has very different valences in different communities, right? So in the community that we operate in primarily now, that's an important... You know, pluralism is the catchphrase for... it's the social norm, right? And so there's a question about whether or not, you talk about sort of finding liberalism finding its space within realism, right? Pluralism is currently the acceptable space to say, give us some space to do stuff. And I think Patrick is a rather sharp, well, personally, I think, this is a sort of sharp take on that, right? But anyway, we could...
we've probably pass on that.
But this is a book that's having much more impact outside of the United States than it's having in the United States.
I would have told you that. I could have told you that from the beginning. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So there's only one wager in the U.S. Mm-hmm. They're not four wagers.
So, well, part of Patrick's argument is that there are two and they're being confused with one. And I think at the very minimum, that's a fairly important
intervention. Well, yes, I will grant that's more subtle than that. Yeah. But there certainly aren't four wagers.
That's true. But, excuse me. So you were saying that at this point you accrue enough, social and symbolic capital that you can then just bestow it on other works. Right. But you are actively teaching now in Brazil, and that's got to, do you see your role as in somehow in part of the how does that situate within this globalization environment, besides the fact that you are teaching in Brazil and that would not have been an option 20 or 30 years ago?
Right. Yeah. I don't know what I can say about this except that I'm retired. Mm-hmm. Normally when you retire you go away. Mm-hmm. But I'm not ready to go away. I retired so that I could continue to function as a scholar without having to teach 150 kids who didn't want to be sitting in a basic lecture class and that kind of thing. So I still think I have something to say. I don't think I have something to say of the consequence I did 20 years ago, needless to say. Mm-hmm. But I'm engaged in a scholarly enterprise, which I take to be in some ways the best way for international relations to come out of the swamp. And I think we've been in the swamp for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. The best way to come out of the swamp is to say what we call international relations is part of the superstructure of modernity. We're talking about the modern world. Mm-hmm. A guy like Dan Nexon writes a book on centuries past, many centuries past, he's writing about the same phenomenon, because modernity is an experience of several centuries. We can't know where we are today without having gone back and done the kind of spade work Dan has done. Exceedingly well, I might add.
Thank you. There are some real historical errors in that book, but we won't go into that.
Sure, okay, but you're not an historian.
Right.
Well, I'm happy.
The historians have been more generous to me than the political scientists who, you know their history, but that's another story. I'll tell you, after we're done, I'll tell you something funny about that, but go ahead.
Okay. So you and I mm-hmm. are actually engaged in the same project. Mm-hmm. Which is to get some sense of what it means for modernity to have been what it was, become what it is, going where it may, and has had the effects it will everywhere. That's a big project.
Well, this is what you're describing, right? I mean, I come out of having briefly been a social studies major at Harvard, right? And I don't know if you know much about the program.
Yeah, no, I knew something about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, and the whole contention, the whole wager of that program is that, you know, modern social science, as we understand it now, is this project to understand what the heck happened that made our lives, our modern lives, different than the lives of people beforehand. You know, and this, you know, this is why the 19th century is such a hot time, in part, you know, is that people are like, whoa, this is really different. What does this mean?
Right. And in fact, it means that we're very close to sociology.
Yeah.
And sociology, of course, took form in the latter part of the 19th century as a modernist process of functional differentiation in which sociologists were assigned the modern world. That's their thing. But they have, as a consequence, had a lot. They, more than anyone else, have had something to say about globalization. Mm-hmm. But we have, it seems to me, something to say that they can't say as clearly as we. What we can say is that a distinctive feature, maybe the most distinctive feature of the modern world, is that unlike any other so-called civilization, we haven't been organized as a single unit.
Hmm.
We've had, and the Enlightenment philosophers were the first ones to observe this. We're different because we've had these multiple power centers, these multiple centers of sovereignty, whatever they are, however they have manifested themselves over a period of several centuries. It's a unique human experience with utterly unanticipated consequences. And sociologists are almost always, there are exceptions, there are world sociologists, but in general, they are so preoccupied with the social experience of their own industrial societies or industrializing societies that they don't grasp that big picture, which is that the system of states, whatever we mean by that, has an orienting impact on the way our world is. That can't simply be left out of the equation. Sociologists either talk about their own societies or they talk about globalization as if there's a global society. They don't recognize the one part of the equation that's ours. It's been ours from the beginning, which is that there's a multiplicity of units that call themselves states, that we call states, and that have peculiar properties as such, and continue to do so, even in a globalized world.
All right. Well, that is a great place to wind up.
You like
so,
that?
Thanks so much for agreeing to do this.
It's been a trip.
And I'll let you know when it comes out. Great. Maybe we can do it again sometime.
That would be fun. Right. Thanks.
Congratulations. You've made it to the merciful end of another Duck of Minerva podcast. This was episode 13, featuring a conversation with Nicholas Onuf. It was recorded November 9th, 2012, in lovely Baltimore, Maryland. So long, folks.